I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. You probably know by now that Elon Musk is set to buy Twitter for $44 billion. The influential social media platform has fewer users than Facebook, now called Meta, and TikTok, and has yet to turn a profit. So why does the world's richest man want to own Twitter? And how does this self-described free speech absolutist imagine how the site will work once he's in charge? Well, we got a partial answer when he was interviewed at a TED Live event on April 14th.
Twitter has become kind of the de facto town square. It's really important that people have both the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law. One of the things that I believe Twitter should do is open source the algorithm. And make any changes to people's tweets, you know, if they're emphasized or de-emphasized, that action should be made apparent so anyone can see that action has been taken. So there's no sort of behind-the-scenes manipulation, either algorithmically or manually.
We asked Izzy Lipowski to get our conversation started to talk about the latest that we know in this deal. She is chief correspondent for Protocol, covering the intersection of technology, politics, and national affairs. And Izzy Lipowski, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Talking about Musk and Twitter, are they still in negotiations? Is this a done deal?
I think it's pretty close to a done deal. I mean, the latest breaking news is that Elon has actually secured another $7 billion from a bunch of his, you know, buddies to help him pull this off. So it puts a little bit less of Elon Musk's money on the line. He's brought a lot more people in. I think that is a pretty strong signal that he and all these other people are very serious about it. Of course, things can change.
Sure.
People can walk away. It's very expensive to do that. But I think we're seeing it get only more and more serious.
And here's the question that probably only Elon Musk can answer, but I'll put it to you, Issy. He's obviously the most successful electric vehicle maker in the world. With Tesla, he's developed a successful rocket program with SpaceX. He's a prolific user of Twitter. Why does he want to own and run this platform?
Yeah, I think you hit on a few of them. He is a prolific user, and so he wants to basically mold the platform in his image. He also is somebody who likes a tremendous challenge. Like you said, rockets, electric vehicles, solar energy, things like that. You know, this is a whole different ball of wax for Elon. He hasn't worked on any sort of social media platforms, and there are many, many ways in which these platforms are broken. He is obviously somebody who feels that he has the capacity to fix it. He also, I will say, is sort of steeped in this culture of, you know, right of center libertarian audience. Definitely a lot of his supporters would fall into that category. He is somebody who kind of panders to his audience. And, you know, there's this sort of feeling on the right now that Twitter is among the platforms that is censoring people on the right. And I think, you know, this is part of Elon Musk kind of giving the people what they want.
You wrote about Elon Musk, and this was about a month ago, in Protocol, on the short list of Twitter troublemakers. Elon Musk has got a rank something near the tippy top. Trump may have had him beat for a while, but he's already been banned for life. So the title goes to Musk, a fully grown man and billionaire whose tweets have at times been so reckless they have their own federally mandated Twitter sitter. Expand on that, Izzy.
Yes. So the Twitter sitter came into play after Elon Musk, in a very similar scenario, tweeted that he had the funding secured to take Tesla public. The markets obviously went to take Tesla private. The markets obviously responded to that in all kinds of crazy ways. And it was unclear that Musk, in fact, did have the funding secured. So that led to a long lawsuit, ended up, getting him in a lot of trouble with the SEC. And as part of the fallout of that, he was required to have, you know, somebody watch over his tweets about Tesla. So that's just one area where he's gotten into trouble with his Twitter account. He also has faced a lawsuit from, you know, one of the rescue divers who was trying to rescue children from the cave a number of years ago. He accused a diver of being a pedophile and was sued for defamation. He actually won that suit because he said, oh, it was all a big joke. It wasn't meant to be taken seriously.
Wow.
But you see the ways in which this this person who may be the next, you know, at least temporary CEO of Twitter has been one of its most troublesome users.
What do you think will be the hard part for him to go from troller to CEO?
I think he has to wrap his head around how hard this actually is. You know, you played his remarks from the TED conference. He says that, you know, Twitter should basically allow all speech that is legal in all the companies where it operates, which is one thing to say that in the United States, which has very strong First Amendment rights. There are countries around the world where all speech that is legal does not necessarily mean free speech. Take Russia. Right now, they recently passed a disinformation law that says, you know, you cannot call the war in Ukraine a war. There are Twitter's, you know, offices in India were raided a number of years ago over tweets that the company refused to take down in a political context. So legal speech around the world, I think Elon is maybe a little bit naive about what that really means and how free that really is.
He's quoted as saying, I really don't have a business plan. And, you know, he speaks boldly about, but he's obviously done very well in life when it comes to making a lot of money. But how much do you think he'll be constrained by, as you kind of mentioned, the rules and laws that guide social media?
Well, he and Twitter will be constrained as they already are in all of these countries. You know, there are countries where Twitter chooses not to operate for that reason. And same goes for a number of social platforms. I think that he is already eyeing changes that could be made to the platform in the name of, as you said, making more money, because Twitter's certainly not, you know, this big moneymaker that he's going after. He's talked about possibly, you know, charging certain accounts, changing the way Twitter interacts with advertisers. He has the sense that because Twitter is an ad-funded platform, other corporations have too much of a say on what the platform does and doesn't do. So he definitely has changes in mind. But yes, those changes are definitely going to be constrained by the laws in which Twitter operates.
And I saw a tweet mentioning charging corporations and government to use Twitter. Is that what you're referring to?
That's what I'm referring to. Yes, he says that, you know, Twitter should always be free for most people, but there are certain accounts that maybe should have to pay. Unclear what the real motivation for that is, except for making money, because if anybody has the capacity to pay, it's certainly not going to encourage those politicians or businesses to necessarily behave better on the platform. They have the capacity to pay if they want to.
Now, my understanding, there's something like 7,500 employees at Twitter. Is that right?
Something around that. I don't have an exact number, but yes, thousands of employees. And, you know, there's been this real concern because many of them have been there for a long time and seen the challenges that the company has gone through. You know, all of these social platforms, Twitter included, started with exactly the idea that Elon Musk wants to pursue, that we should be a free speech platform and that, you know, essentially anything can go. And they've seen, you know, where that goes wrong, and they've seen where the guardrails have to be put up in place. I think a lot of them are fearful of going backwards and having to relearn or re-educate their new CEO about the tough lessons they've learned.
Well, and that's one of the questions, which is, do they educate him or does he force them to change the rules to fit his vision of free speech?
Right. I mean, well, if he owns the platform, if he becomes the CEO, I think he's going to have a lot of power there. I think that you're probably going to see a lot of pushback, but he clearly has already been speaking sort of, well, very critically about some of the current executives who have made those decisions over the years, whether those executives even get to stick around to participate in that re-education process, I think is unclear.
Will he tolerate criticism of Tesla on Twitter?
You know, he says he says that it's going to be a free speech platform, so you would certainly hope so. But there are a lot of questions about what it means for, you know, for instance, criticism of China and the government there, which, you know, in Elon's other businesses, he definitely relies on the good graces of China. So these have been questions that a lot of people have been asked, and so that will really be a test of how committed he is to this idea of free speech.
As you mentioned, he's a libertarian. I mean, Twitter, from my perspective, leans, I would say, left and democratic. Would you agree with that?
It's, I don't know the exact breakdown, and I think this is sort of the question all of these companies have been asked is, you know, what, who is having the most success? Mm-hmm. Who has the largest share of voice on your platforms? They're not always so willing to share those numbers. But I think that, yes, there's certainly a large contingent of, you know, lefty Twitter. But, you know, there's, as you can probably see, Elon does pretty good numbers. So I think he's got a pretty significant following.
Do you imagine, though, with his politics that it might be more attractive to also libertarians, also maybe Republicans, conservatives to come back to Twitter or to try Twitter out?
Right. Well, it was really interesting, actually, yesterday, Senator Ted Cruz was talking during a hearing about the changes he'd seen to his own follower count since Elon announced he was acquiring Twitter. He said he went from about 1,000 new followers a day to, in recent weeks, about 70,000 new followers a day.
Wow.
He said this has been something he's been seeing across, you know, his conservative colleagues. There have been a few analyses about this. So it does seem like folks who, you know, maybe weren't on the platform or weren't as active on the platform are coming back and, you know, getting energized around this news.
It seems a big test once he takes over Twitter officially will be whether he invites Donald Trump back on Twitter. Now, Trump was kicked off after the insurrection and developed his own platform called Truth Social. Hasn't done very well, as I understand it. I don't even think Trump uses his own social media platform. But how do you see this particular issue?
I think it's all but certain that Elon would bring Trump's, would restore Trump's account and restore the accounts of lots of people who have been suspended over the years. I think that is a big motivation of his. And it's certainly a big motivation of, you know, these many folks who just joined him in contributing to the acquisition. One of the people who contributed to the $7 billion is Larry Ellison, who is, you know, a big time conservative donor and the founder of Oracle. So yes, I think it's all but certain that Elon would restore the accounts of people who have been suspended, not just Trump. It's a question as to whether Trump will rejoin. He has said he has not, that he would not, because he wants to, you know, see Truth Social through. But as you just mentioned, he has not been a very active participant on Truth Social. I think it would be pretty tough for Trump to resist going back to Twitter, given his prior success.
And in 30 seconds, is there an answer to why Truth Social really never took off?
The rollout was really botched. They didn't onboard people immediately. They gave people really long wait lists. And, you know, part of the fun, I think, if you are a really big conservative troll, is to troll the libs. And if the libs aren't there, then what fun is it?
That's true. I hadn't thought about that reason. That makes a lot of sense. Well, Izzy Lipowski, thank you so much for joining us today, getting our conversation started.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she is chief correspondent for Protocol, covering the intersection of technology, politics, and national affairs. And we are talking about the fact that Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, is set to officially purchase Twitter for $44 billion. We want to know if you think this is an important story, if you care one way or the other, if you use Twitter. We certainly want to hear from you as well, what you make of this news. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. After weeks of will he, won't he, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, is buying the social media platform Twitter for $44 billion. While it has fewer users than Facebook, Meta, and TikTok, and is yet to turn a profit, Twitter does have enormous influence on the media and our political discourse. Musk has been a prolific user of Twitter, as we heard, and he says he wants to bring his belief in unfettered speech to the platform, which has had incidents of harassment and disinformation, racism, misogyny, and trolling, including by Musk himself. So how might Musk remake Twitter, and what will his free speech absolutism look like in practice? Also, is our democracy at risk when billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Rupert Murdoch and Mark Zuckerberg control powerful media companies? We asked David Kaye to join us. He's a professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, co-director of Fair Elections and the Free Speech Center. He's also the former UN Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression, and wrote a book called Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. David Kaye, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Well, as I was mentioning to our first guest, Izzy Lipowski, there's so much speculation about what Elon Musk is going to do once he officially owns Twitter. But he certainly has left some breadcrumbs that we can talk about. He describes us as a digital town square. He describes himself as a free speech absolutist. How do you understand what Musk means when he describes himself that way?
Yeah, I mean, you're right to describe it as kind of breadcrumbs, although there's a lot of them because Elon Musk is an inveterate tweeter. He really speaks his mind. You know, I think that when he talks about free speech, he's thinking about it in somewhat kind of simplistic terms. I mean, I think what he's thinking is free speech is about the speaker, you know, the individual's right to speak her mind or his mind, their mind. And he's not really thinking about the broader effort that any online platform has to think about, which is how do you maximize access for all users to the platform? How do you maximize access to information? How do you really create a platform where everybody has freedom of expression? And so I think that that's, you know, sort of as a starting point, he has a very primitive kind of grade school way of thinking about what free speech is.
And free speech is from his perspective, what I say, what he says, rather than how the audience receives it or is affected by it.
I think that's right. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with his promotion of free speech. I mean, I think there's something, you know, at one level that's really quite impressive about his commitment. But, you know, if you think about how the First Amendment, for example, frames free speech, it's, you know, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press. It feels and seems very focused on the speaker. But Twitter is a global platform. And people outside the United States don't think in First Amendment terms. They think in terms of sort of the human right to free expression, which guarantees the rights not only of speakers, but also those who are seeking and receiving information, audiences. And I think that broader way of thinking about free speech, which is still a free speech norm, and one can be an absolutist around free speech, but also think about audiences and the marginalized and those others who may not have the same kind of power to speak that Elon Musk has.
Well, as we know, Twitter has been accused and has had incidents of harassment. And I mentioned this in my introduction, disinformation, racism, misogyny, and trolling, and on from there. So once, and has tried probably incompletely to try to police that stuff, once he takes over at the helm, is he going to have to deal with that?
Absolutely. I mean, what I think, you know, from those breadcrumbs that we're getting from him, I would imagine, much as Izzy Lipowski was suggesting previously, I would imagine that Elon Musk would seek to loosen some of those rules, if not get rid of those rules altogether. And I think that he would find very quickly that getting rid of the rules will mean, you know, more toxic content, the kind of content that might make advertisers wary of putting their money into the platform, but also really exclude a lot of users who have come to rely on a set of rules that, you know, they're not perfect. Mm-hmm. I don't hold a brief for Twitter, but they have sought over the last, say, 5 to 7 years to protect individuals, you know, who might be subject to harassment, or protect the public in the face of different kinds of, say, public health disinformation. And I think there'll be a lot of pressure on Musk to actually adhere to some of those rules in particular contexts that, you know, right now it's hard to know what will arise, but I'm sure that pressure will exist.
What gives Twitter its clout? I mentioned the fact that it has fewer users than Facebook or TikTok, but it does have enormous influence. Where does that come from?
Yeah, Twitter, it's interesting. You know, it's very different from, say, Facebook, where, you know, people on Facebook exchange photos of, you know, of their friends, of their kids, of their, you know, their pets. And, you know, it's much more kind of, you know, social in that way, but like a little bit closer to one's maybe offline friend group. Twitter has much more of a public facing role. I mean, it does have the social part of it, but, you know, it has tremendous usage by journalists, by politicians, by, you know, what we might think of as influencers, you know, business people like Elon Musk. And so it's not that it is, you know, he refers to it as a public square. I don't think of it so much as a public square as much as really a kind of media platform in which people seek to influence public debate. And I think that's where, in part because of the elite users that it has, it draws a lot of its power from that.
I was reading in preparation for the show, according to Pew, about 20% of Americans use Twitter. So that's obviously a minority. 60% are either Democrats or Democratic leaning, 35% Republican or Republican leaning. Does that sort of fit your profile of what you think Twitter is?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds right for an American audience. And right. I just want to emphasize that, you know, the majority of the platform's users are outside the United States. But that does make sense. Although I would say that, you know, notwithstanding the user base and maybe its kind of left-leaning quality in that sense, you know, there are conservative voices on Twitter that have huge followings, right, you know, into the millions. And so I think it really has become a place for, you know, kind of the reach, you know, sort of the putting of ideas out there to very large audiences. But again, I would also say that in some respects, it's not so much the user base that's important in terms of the numbers, but in terms of who is on it. Right. So if a journalist is on Twitter and that journalist is writing a story about a particular issue, they're going to do their research on Twitter and they may include a tweet in their reporting. Right. And that extends the reach of the platform well beyond those who are actually using the platform.
I was reading some a piece actually by Ezra Klein, and he talked about Twitter being about how to get attention in this very crowded world of news and information, this environment of news and information. Do you see it that way? And I have to say, I mean, Trump, when he was on Twitter, was very good at getting attention. Musk as well.
There's a way in which, you know, high volume follower accounts, you know, people like, you know, former President Trump or Elon Musk use the platform in a very fluid way, but also with a high level of, you might think of it as kind of shock value. I mean, they use the platform to provoke, and, you know, provocation often leads to virality. That means, you know, more people will share it. But there's also a kind of inauthentic part of Twitter in which, you know, some accounts and some tweets get boosted, you know, sometimes by bots, but sometimes by, you know, real live humans who are in a way coordinating their effort to boost particular kinds of content. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it does create a sense of Twitter valuing popularity of posts rather than, you know, necessarily, you know, the excellence or the contribution of the post to, you know, considered deliberative public debate.
And popularity meaning provocative, right?
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of research that shows that, you know, a more negative sounding tweet, a tweet that's critical, a tweet that is, you know, provoking with a big idea, those tend to get attention. You know, not always. It helps if you already have a huge number of followers. But we definitely see that there's a connection between provocation and attention.
Well, we're talking with David Kay about the fact that the world's richest man is buying Twitter. Elon Musk, who describes himself as a free speech absolutist, is ready to put down $44 billion for the social media platform. We're talking about what that could mean, because it obviously hasn't happened yet, but a lot of speculation about what Musk may or may not do. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us. We have a Twitter account at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. David, I asked Izzy, you know, how will Musk handle it when people use Twitter to criticize Tesla? And I asked that because I saw that, and this is an article that was in CNBC, these are separation agreements. People that work at Tesla are asked or even forced to sign these separation agreements. And here's what one of them says. You agree not to disparage Tesla, the company products, or the company's officers, directors, employees, shareholders, and agents, affiliates, and subsidiaries in any manner likely to be harmful to them or their business reputation, or personal reputation. How can Musk call himself a free speech absolutist when he once fired or laid off employees to sign this agreement?
It's a great question. I mean, and I think it's a question that should be posed to Elon Musk,
sure,
first and foremost, right? But I do think there's a way in which his tweeting and his public statements promoting freedom of expression are in conflict with the way he's run his companies.
Yeah.
And, you know, even, you know, kind of famously, he got rid of the public relations department at Tesla a couple of years ago. And so, you know, he has had a kind of tendentious relationship with the press. And, you know, one can understand that in part as the result of his, you know, hard charging effort to make Tesla a kind of, you know, successful car company. And he overdid it in that respect. And, you know, maybe he's learned something. You know, let's try to imagine a little good faith there. But I do think that you're right to point that out, that there's a real conflict between the way he thinks about free speech for his employees and his businesses and free speech on Twitter. Those things do not seem to be consistent with one another.
Here's a comment from Jim. He says, I'm worried that people like Musk and Trump see free speech as anarchy and don't see how important it is for the speaker to have responsibility. And David, that was something you were talking about. From your perspective, you see Musk as someone who sees free speech as free for the speaker without looking at its impact on the audience.
I think that's right, and I think it's a really good comment. I think it's useful to think about the platform, you know, in particular Twitter, but it could be any online platform, and think about what they're trying to do. So, you know, all of these platforms have a strong business interest in increasing the number of users and, you know, in fact, increasing the number of posts and tweets that they put out there, because, you know, those posts, those tweets, that's data. That's what they use in order to attract advertisers. That's that kind of, you know, robust use of the platform, which is a kind of, you know, a free speech issue. It's also a business issue for the mm-hmm. platforms. And so from the platform's perspective, they want to be encouraging everyone to feel that they have space to speak. And the problem with this, I think it's right to think of it as a kind of anarchic view of free speech, that everybody can just speak.
Right.
The problem with that view is that in practice, that leads to more harassment, to more, you know, hateful content, however we define it. And that could be something, you know, that needs to be better defined as well. But that kind of content really serves to push people off the platform and to make it harder for them to feel that they can engage, you know, as equals with others who are speaking. And so that's, I think that's a way of thinking about free speech also. It's a way of thinking about responsibility, but it's also a way of thinking about how the platform itself needs rules in order to make sure that everybody feels that they can speak on the platform.
I mean, can you have a free speech platform, Twitter, that includes white supremacists or COVID deniers or Sandy Hook deniers or harassers or terrorists? I mean, is there a way that everyone can all speak equally to each other?
It's hard to imagine, right? I mean, we don't have to sort of hypothesize in a way because, you know, early in its development, Twitter put itself out there as, you know, they said famously, the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. Mm-hmm. They were very much about allowing everybody space to speak. But they did find that over time, as it became a place where neo-Nazis, white supremacists, you know, kind of COVID deniers in the last couple of years, you know, others were really creating a kind of toxic environment for all their users. And it made it very uncomfortable for advertisers. You know, they didn't want their advertisements or, you know, or their promoted tweets to be sitting alongside white supremacist content. And, you know, and it made it difficult for people who were really trying to use the platform to engage in good faith debate to be doing that when you had trolls who were, you know, expressing racist, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, white supremacist kind of content alongside your efforts at real debate. So it's hard to know how, you know, Musk's, you know, free speech absolutism will will ultimately develop if that kind of really toxic content comes back to be a part of the platform.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Yes, we are talking about Elon Musk and Twitter. And our guest is David Kay, professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, co-director of Fair Elections and the Free Speech Center, wrote a book called Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. And we are talking about Musk's vision of free speech. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with David Kay about Elon Musk and Twitter. David, a couple of comments here about just the price tag. Paul asks, if it doesn't make any money, why is Twitter worth $44 billion? And a tweet from CD, $44 billion is a lot for a commercial enterprise that doesn't make any money. Now, you're a free speech person. I don't know if you have an answer to why its value at $44 billion, but nonetheless it is.
Yeah, it's true. I'm not a business expert, but you know, I do think two reactions to that. One is that $44 billion, it's a lot of money, but it's nowhere close to the value of Facebook or YouTube, for example. Its value, though, I think really does come from its influence. Yeah. And that is clearly what Elon Musk sees. He's not only a user, but I think he's pretty sophisticated in terms of understanding how, you know, he can use the platform in order to promote, you know, his brand, his personal brand, how he could promote his companies. I think that value is shared by others, you know, by businesses, by journalists, by others, and that creates the value that it has. You know, why somebody would spend that much for something that doesn't make much money is another question that only Musk can answer, but I think that influence is definitely part of it.
I mentioned this in my introduction. Elon Musk, obviously a billionaire, wants to buy Twitter. We're also talking about Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, Rupert Murdoch and Fox, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. Obviously, these are enormously wealthy people, influential people that own these powerful media companies. Is that a new trend, and does this worry you?
So I think the first thing is that it's nothing new. Wealthy people have owned and they've sought to own media outlets for generations. You know, one of the most famous American movies, Citizen Kane, is really exactly about that, right? It's about, you know, a media mogul, and that has historically, you know, had a kind of distorting effect on our media environment. There's no question about that. But I would distinguish, and it's instructive in a way, distinguishing Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post from Elon Musk buying Twitter. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, he pretty explicitly said, you know, I want this this media outlet to survive and to thrive, and I won't mess with their editorial choices. I won't change their editorial rules. The opposite is happening with respect to Musk buying Twitter. He is saying, not only do I want this thing, this platform to survive, but I also want to change the rules. He right. wants to get involved. In a way, it's similar to, or it's closer to, the Murdoch ownership of Fox than it is to Bezos owning the Washington Post. He really does want a kind of editorial control.
Here's an email from Kay. She says, one of the groups now banned are those who disagree with radical trans ideology. Many feminists have been censored and banned. I don't think a point of view should have been banned, especially since that point of view and information is not allowed on media like NPR and The New York Times. I can't speak for The New York Times, but, you know, we welcome as many diverse ideas as we possibly can. But, you know, it does, David, get to a finer point about, you know, who's in and who's out and what are the criteria?
It's a good point. And, you know, though I can't speak to the specifics of the particular rule that's mentioned in that comment, I do think that, you know, Twitter, as with Facebook and YouTube and other big social media platforms, they have been better in recent years at telling people what their rules are, mm-hmm. but they have not been that good at articulating how they make their decisions and showing people that there's some consistency. And a good example is, you know, that all the platforms have rules around hate speech, and they all more or less define it similarly. I mean, they do not want there to be incitement to discrimination and hostility and violence, particularly violence on their platforms. But because they don't open up their decision-making process to public scrutiny, we don't really have a good sense as to how consistent the application of those rules is. So, you know, does it, in a way, hit some communities harder than others? Does it result in more content being taken down when it relates to certain viewpoints as to others? You know, we really don't have much of the data around that because the platforms don't open themselves up to that kind of scrutiny. To the extent that Elon Musk talks about transparency, if he pushes Twitter in that direction, I mean, that could be one of the positives of his ownership because it could push in an appropriate way. But at the moment, we don't really have a good sense of how those rules all kind of shape out in a consistent way.
And that clip that we played from the TED event, I mean, he seemed to at least hint that there might be more openness to seeing how decisions are made or how the, you know, how the sausage is made at Twitter.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he's talked about it in terms of, you know, what he's called algorithmic transparency. You know, tell us what the algorithm is, give people more control. Honestly, it shows a little bit of a kind of simplistic view of how Twitter works because there isn't just one algorithm. I mean, there's kind of a range of technologies that work to automate things, but also to enable the recommendation systems. You know, you get recommended a tweet, for example, you know, enables those to work in certain ways. And I do think he's right to say we need to know more about how that works. But you know, we should also know more about how the rules are enforced. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would hope that he would think about transparency of the rulemaking as a first order of business before saying the rules are bad, because I think that the rules are designed, even if they're not perfect, they're designed to expand freedom of expression on the platform, and he should be thinking in those terms rather than simply thinking, you know, the rules are bad and they harm speech.
We're talking about Elon Musk, Twitter, and free speech with our guest, David Kaye. You can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call that phone number as 1-888-477-9499. Stephanie says Musk has said that he would do things like give us an edit option for tweets. And she says, I want that. And, you know, who hasn't sent out a tweet and then regretted that you sent it, but also wanted to fix some of the spelling mistakes or whatever.
Yeah, it is very popular. And, you know, people have, of course, anybody who tweets knows, you know, it's not necessarily the place for, you know, kind of polishing up your prose. All sorts of content ends up on the platform that you might not have intended. And that is a popular idea. I think there are issues that the company would need to work through, and there are reasons why it hasn't come to pass so far. For example, you know, how do you deal with the problem of somebody, you know, tweeting something that, you know, the grammar's fine, but the content is either problematic or it becomes very popular and it gets a lot of likes. Yeah. And then later on, the individual edits that tweet to say something different, but it has all these likes still attached to it. So how do you deal with that kind of problem? It's not insurmountable. I mean, there are ways to deal with that, but and Musk seems to think that's something that would be popular on the platform, and he's probably correct in that. But I think that the platform needs to do some study to make sure that if it were to do that, it doesn't have some kind of inadvertent or incidental harms that it doesn't actually want to promote.
You mentioned the fact that Twitter has a global reach. My understanding, the EU has some new regulations for social media. I was also reading in the Washington Post about Saudi Arabia. I'll just quote a sentence or two. The problem of Twitter's relationship with Saudi Arabia, the service's most popular Middle Eastern market, journalists, analysts, and dissidents have documented the Saudi government's use of troll farms and nationalist influencers. And in an episode that should be more notorious than it is, its establishment of a spying operation inside Twitter's headquarters. As we look around the world, what are some of the concerns that you have?
Yeah, so this is really the most troubling part of, or one of the most troubling parts of what Musk has said is that the way he thinks of free speech and the way the platform should deal with free speech is essentially all speech should be on the table, on the platform, okay, unless it's inconsistent with the law.
Right.
And that might work, you know, at least from a free speech perspective to a certain extent in the United States, where, you know, the law doesn't allow the government to intervene in content, in viewpoint discrimination. But if you think about a place like Saudi Arabia or any number of authoritarian environments around the world, the law is often extremely repressive. And in Saudi Arabia, it could be repressive with respect to religious freedom, repressive with respect to gender identity or sexual orientation, or any number of other things, criticism of the government, which is common around the world as well. And so, you know, in a way, when Musk says consistent with the law, he's kind of opening himself up and opening Twitter up to being an adjunct to, complicit with, government repression of speech. That's a problem. And, you know, the platforms have really resisted this. Twitter in particular, in the last year or two, has tried to resist the efforts of the government of India to essentially censor content on Twitter. I mean, there's been pushback from Twitter. But if Musk is saying, you know, we just defer to the law, that is in many, many environments around the world, including those where Twitter is popular, you know, that could lead to real serious censorship that Twitter would then be participating in.
Yeah, something to really keep an eye on. Richard asks, does the defamation standard that applies to published newspapers apply to social media platforms? If it doesn't currently apply, how long will this legal distinction between social media platforms and newspapers endure? I mean, that's a big question, David, but what are your thoughts about that?
It's a very big question, and it's the kind of question that requires different answers depending on which jurisdiction you're in. Because, of course, you know, much as, you know, the platform is global, it also does bear responsibilities in different environments, in different countries, to observe, you know, local law, such as the civil law around defamation. Now, in the United States, the companies themselves are protected under this kind of famous Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. That it's a law from the 1990s that provides the companies with immunity from lawsuit with respect to the content that they're hosting. So they couldn't be responsible for, you know, for defamation, essentially. But it also provides them with immunity concerning the rules that they make. And it's been, Section 230 has been a tool for the companies to actually create rules that allow them to deal with harassment, defamation. We could think about things like doxing, you know, when individuals publish, say, the local address or the personal details of people as a form of harassment. That, you know, the on the one hand, that might seem like a free speech issue, but on the other, it's an interference with an individual's privacy, and Section 230 has given the platforms the space to create rules around that kind of content. So, you know, those things vary, but there's a very different treatment of the platforms, of internet platforms generally, and newspapers, which, you know, have, you know, under Supreme Court precedent, under the First Amendment, have a lot of protection, but they don't have the same kind of protection against lawsuits that the platforms have.
Let me squeeze in a comment from Martin on our Facebook page. He says, the same people who are now complaining about Twitter being owned by Musk also complained about Twitter being controlled by a board of directors that answered to investors. We can't have it both ways. We can't say we don't want Twitter to be publicly owned and we don't want it to be privately owned. Do you understand what he's talking about there, David?
I think so. I mean, I think this goes to a very fundamental question about gatekeeping and who's making the rules, who the rules are for. You know, Twitter has, over the last several years, tried to create rules that are kind of responsive to their users and to the public's desire that Twitter not be a place that harms public institutions, that it promotes the public interest in some ways, promotes, like in Twitter's words, they've said, promotes or serves the public conversation. But at the same time, you know, the platforms and, you know, Twitter has been owned by the wealthy. And sort of moving into this space of being owned by one particular person with a particular view of what free speech means, I think, you know, that has created this whole debate over the last month, you know, this idea that the rules are susceptible to change according to who owns them. It's the reality, but I think it's a reality that a lot of people are just uncomfortable with.
Well, we have to leave it there. David Kaye, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. He's a professor at the University of California Irvine School of Law, co-director of Fair Elections and the Free Speech Center. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also and always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.